It's 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon, welcome to Flavour, and thanks to Ian Dayborn, and enjoy the glycerin, Ian. I'm Alan Alder.
I'm Ruth Reyes. There's no Matt Bentman today, most unusual. He's at a family event and will be back with us next time. But Julian Clover is here from 105 Drive and he's doing all the technical stuff. Are you much of a foodie, Julian?
I'm very lucky to be taken to lots of really nice restaurants. Invariably somebody else is paying at the time.
Oh dear.
Lucky.
Don't go out with Julian. On today's programme, we've got features on Rioja wines, buying cheese in Cambridge, really good top quality cheese that is. We've the predicted food trends for 2016. There's tips on growing your own fruit and vegetables and the first news about this year's Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival. We've also got the Cambridge City and University food and drink news, and Gigi Perry from Cambridge University will be along later to join us with that.
But first off, we reported in our last episode's news section about the upcoming launch of the Cambridge Food Assembly, an initiative that proved a winner at the BBC Food and Farming Awards. Matt went along to the inauguration of the Food Assembly, which was a week last Wednesday, to get some comments about from all involved.
My name's Richard Widows. I'm one of the co-founders of the Cambridge Food Assembly. My background's actually in agriculture, so I'm really interested in local food and making produce more available to people.
The Food Assembly is a new weekly event that makes it easy for people who don't have the time but want to support locally made produce. Get your cheese from one place in the city, your meat from another, greens and veg from elsewhere. All of this takes time, and it can mean a lot of darting around. The Food Assembly lets you order what you want from the people that you want. You place your orders online at a single website which features all of the local producers, and then you collect it all from one place. Espresso Library on East Road, run by John Gull and Malgo Zierugo.
Yeah, they're fantastic. You know, the Espresso Library is just such an ethical business, and it's like, I don't think we could find a better partner to work with.
And when Rich told us about the Food Assembly, we thought, wow, that's brilliant, because it talks through the fact that we can encourage building community, we can encourage people to make similar choices by buying local.
And I think that this model is quite unique in what it does to put agriculture back in the centre of community.
They've all come out of our field today, so it's very fresh. So you're welcome.
So you are responsible for contacting all the local food producers and farmers. Are we talking people from, say, like a 20, 30 mile radius?
I think the furthest producer here tonight is about 40 miles away. They're Hodmadods, and they're sort of a really interesting producer that's bringing back British grains. We try and keep it as local as possible, but that's an example of a producer that we think is really doing good things and the sort of producer that we think our members would be really interested in.
These are delicious roasted fava beans from Hodmadods Food.
With some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Fava beans are grown in Norwich. It's an ancient UK crop that in more recent times has been exported to other countries or used as a supplement in animal food. They're making a bit of a comeback now, and the roasted samples that I tried on the night were delicious. You could easily, and idly, polish off a bowlful in one sitting. Well, I could anyway.
I'm looking forward to it as an ongoing concept. There's a lot of training involved in tonight's effort for us, for the producers, and for the customers as well, because the Food Assembly is quite a new model. The model started in France. There's over 700 of these assemblies in France now.
What's great about the Food Assembly is that you get to meet and chat with the producers whose food you're buying.
Lovely. It's always nice to be asked and answer questions, so it's good. Yeah, I'm happy to meet the customers. It's brilliant.
That's grand. And then I guess ideas get passed to and fro.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, we can explain our products. They'll hopefully go back and taste it this week, and I'll have some feedback next week as well. So, and I've already had ideas for recipes and given them some, and customers have given me some too, so it's been excellent. Yeah.
So this evening's been very busy, nice buzz in the room. It's really good to get positive feedback and be able to do tastings for your customers and actually see the reactions on their faces.
My name is Anna. I'm from the Honey Shed Bakery. I'm based about 10 miles from here, south of Newmarket. At the moment, I'm selling cakes and homemade bread. The night is going well. Everybody seems to like the cakes that I bake, so I bought lots of samples. Although I understand that January normally is a dry month for cakes because everybody overindulges in Christmas. But they seem to be taking the samples well, so I'm really happy.
So I represent Lord Conrad's Brewery. We're based at Dry Drayton and we make ale by hand using local ingredients. Yes, we've got a great range with us today. We've got Spiffing Wheeze, which is a light pale ale. We've got Conkerwood, which is a darker ale with licorice. We've got some mulled cider. We've even got some gluten-free beer.
And it's not the same as a farmer's market because people are buying ahead of time. You know, there were quite a few people that turned up tonight and wanted to buy produce from the producers, and it's just not how the model works. So yeah, there's quite a bit of education involved, but that's part of the fun.
Hi, would you like some garlic goat's cheese on organic sourdough bread? The bread's from Cobb's Bakery and the cheese is from Mobley Bottom Farm.
The thing I like about the food assembly is that it's a great model for people to form connections with where their food comes from and the producers in the local area. So that's what we're trying to do here.
My name's Tricia Hewlett and I'm owner of the Moonbeam Food Company. I live in Histon and I make all my products from home.
Tricia makes things with raw chocolate, unroasted cacao beans, kept at a temperature of less than 45 degrees so that it retains all the nutrients.
I stone grind the nibs myself in a stone grinder. I use unrefined sugars, everything's dairy-free, gluten-free. Yeah, you could call it a healthy chocolate, I suppose.
We have, but everything's pre-ordered on the internet, and, you know, we've cut what we need today to order, so no wastage at all, which is fantastic.
So that's a really another very important part of the model, that there is very little waste, because farmers know what they're selling before they turn up. They bring exactly what was ordered. I've just gone and spoken to all the producers, and actually our orders were pretty good tonight for the first night. We didn't get much wrong. There wasn't any leftovers. So that's quite a nice aspect. Farmers markets, you know, farmers will go along and take a lot of produce, and sometimes they'll sell it all and sometimes they won't. And then they've got to take that produce home again and find something to do with it. So this model is really good in that respect.
People can come down here on an evening and instead of going to the local supermarket, market squares, we've got bread, we've got meats, we've got drinks.
You know, breweries used to form part of the local community through the pub. And in today's terms, I think we support local communities through events like this.
Vegetables as well, and they can get it from one place. And I think that's going to be a big alternative for the people who are looking for sustainable groceries in Cambridge. They can come here and get it. So it's a good option.
Hi, I'm Peter from Wild Country Organics. We're a local organic farm and we're here this evening with a great crowd, as you can hear. So it's my first time. I've never done anything like this before and it's fantastic. So people seem to be really enjoying it, and it's nice to actually meet with the customers in this sort of informal, almost like a private view. Yeah, I think definitely selling directly rather than going through a wholesaler, you know, we get a better price. Ultimately, the customer does as well that way too, so there's no middleman involved, so it's an ideal scenario for us, this sort of event.
And yeah, it's every week. Tomorrow I'll send out an email to all of the members, and the members list is growing really quickly. We've got over 350 members registered on the website now, which is really great. And I'll announce that next week's market is open, and customers will have 5 days then to purchase produce online. The market will close on Monday night, and then producers have 2 days to collect the orders together and bring them here to the Espresso Library next Wednesday for next week's event.
Once it settles into a groove, it'll actually have a nice little community feel with people coming and you recognise your regular customers and people catching up with each other as a sort of weekly meeting point.
So being able to get the Wild Country Organics, being able to get raw chocolates from some lady I've never heard about, and I'm 99% vegan, so it's really great for me to do that and for everyone to kind of try and reduce the carbon footprint, and that helps. We're very excited that that's going to be a weekly thing, and hopefully more and more people will engage with that.
And many thanks to Richard Widows, co-founder of the Cambridge Food Assembly, and all the producers in this feature. And you can check out their wares via their respective websites. There we heard from some of them, Honeyshed Bakery, Wild Country Organics, the Moonbeam Food Company, and Lord Conran's Brewery, whose fifth anniversary it is this year, by the way. And I popped along to the Cambridge Food Assembly this week, and there was a good number of producers. You know, it's something that's growing, and it's a really good idea, and there's a great atmosphere. And I also took the opportunity to have an Espresso Library gin and tonic when I was there, and it was really good. To get produce, you enrol at the Cambridge Food Assembly website, thefoodassembly.com, see what's available next week from the producers, and place your order by Monday evening. Next week, Pryor's Flour from Foster's Mill will be joining in. They do stone ground organic flours milled by wind power at Foster's Mill at Swaffham Pryor, and they also do great porridge oats.
Mm. And you're listening to Flavour here on Cambridge 105. We're here until 1 p.m. and then it's Bookmark with features this week, former Education Secretary and Home Secretary Charles Clark. But before then, we've all sorts of good things, like cheese. Running over 20 years, the Cambridge Cheese Company sits happily in All Saints Passage, offering some really great products. I spoke with co-owner Jackie Sutton-Adam to learn more about this quietly brilliant little cheese shop.
We're really about sort of good quality, say, traditional food.
Where do you get most of your things from?
All over, really. We work very closely with some suppliers who buy to our specifications. So a lot of our cheese is an arrangement with a supplier who goes to the Paris food market, Le Rungis, every month or so. And he brings back beautiful cheeses, including the heart-shaped goat cheeses that we do for Valentine's Day. So we buy all over, really. We're quite selective. We keep our ears to the ground, listening out for interesting new stuff. And, of course, the thing at the moment is that everybody's quite buzzy about is local food. That's been a really interesting development for us, because when we first started 20-odd years ago, 1994, the big thing was being a delicatessen with... Being an independent delicatessen in Cambridge, we were very much a one-off. As we've kind of developed and grown and had to react to what's happening out there in the market, as new things have come along, and there's been organic food, there's been local food, there's been all sorts of things like that, we have to look really closely at what the new stuff is that is coming in, and how well does it fit our brand at the Cambridge Cheese Company, and how much demand is there from our customer base. So it's a constant juggling act. It's never the same thing 2 years running, really. Cheese wise, I have two favourites. One would be a Pouligny Saint-Pierre, which is a pyramid goat's cheese from sort of central Loire area. So that's my favourite. One of my favourite cheeses. The other one I would say would be a good piece of really strong cheddar, and we do one called Cambridgeshire Gumburner. It's made for us, and we mature it ourselves for up to 2 years, and it has really big, powerful, punchy flavours. It's like somewhere between a cheddar and a parmesan, if you like, in terms of bite and power. So those would be my two favourite things.
Oh, wow. How do you do the maturing? Do you do it here on site? Or?
We do, yes. So we buy a lot of... We buy stuff in from products in from cheesemakers, and sometimes they're able to supply us with big cheeses that have a bit of age on them already, and we buy them in advance. And then we have some maturing rooms downstairs which are kept around about between 5 and 8 degrees centigrade, a little bit of humidity in there. It's an old building, as you can see. We're in a Grade 2 listed bit of the city, so damp is ever present. And that's perfect for cheeses. So we put things down there, and the cheddars can just be left quietly by themselves, a little bit of turning once in a while. And the younger cheeses need a little bit more attention to bring them up to good, fluffy, squidgy deliciousness. And then when they like that, we take them into the shop. One of our specialities is a cheese we call Cambridge Blue. It's made for us, closely guarded secret as to where it comes from. But they have been maturing downstairs, and they go from being creamy and rich and very tasty to ultra creamy, very rich, and almost like soft and oozy. We have a couple of goat's cheeses which are young, beautifully formed. They come to us ready-made, and then we mature them for about three to 4 weeks generally downstairs, and they become sort of soft, bit wrinkly, grey, quite sort of sexy looking. Good things to have on a cheese board. So those are our, I think those are our main ones. And then pretty much everything else that comes in, you know, it's just a question literally on a daily basis. We go round and look at what's down there and, you know, maybe adjust the packaging a little bit or the amount of air circulation that goes around the cheeses in order to create the right environment for that particular cheese. And then when they look nice and ripe and ready, we bring them up, and that's why they sell, because they're up there because they're ripe and ready to go. So, yeah.
What's your favourite product that's not cheese related?
Well, interesting actually. We have just recently started dealing with an Essex-based smokery who does kiln roasted hot smoked salmon, kiln roasted. And it is so succulent. It's apparently caught by a single boat who goes out into the North Atlantic, and he brings a catch back and sells most, about 80% of his catch goes to this one smokery in Essex, and they smoke it, and it's succulent, it's really juicy, and it comes with a range of toppings, and I really like it. And my favourite non-animal product would probably be olives from Greece. We have some big fat green ones called Koroneiki. They're crunchy, and the New Seasons ones, which are probably due in the next month or so, beautiful.
So you started 20 years ago. What made you start the Cambridge Cheese Company?
Okay, so Paul, my husband, and I, we were recently married and living in Norwich, and we had both been working for a wine business, wine retailers, and it was just at the start of the early 90s, there was a recession in the early 90s, and a lot of people got laid off and edged out of jobs, and he and I were two victims of that. So we had been sitting around, newly married, and, you know, just having a relaxing time out from work, but not really confronting the elephant in the room, which was, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives? And we ended up going to a cheese shop in Norwich, which was called The Mousetrap, in order to buy some cheese to take home for family at Christmas. And they didn't have any Stilton, so we ended up having a conversation and a long tasting session with all the different blue cheeses that we could take instead of Stilton. And when we were leaving, my husband said to me, "So I think we could do a cheese shop." And I said, "Oh, yeah, why not? And should we do it in Cambridge?" Because I was really very fond of the city that I spent my early 20s in. I love the vibrancy about it. And in all honesty, I didn't feel very at home in Norwich. So I was looking for a good reason to leave. And that was that. And about less than a year later, we found premises. We bought a cheese deck. We got in touch with a couple of wholesalers. They said, "Yes, of course, we'll come up and help you set your cheese deck up and show you bits of how to merchandise things attractively for your customers." And my husband did a course called a Diploma in Cheese, which allows him to put cheese dip at the end of his name. He doesn't do that. And he and I had both always been, before we found ourselves unemployed in Norwich, we had both done a bit of travelling around Europe, independently and together. And we were both really taken with the, at the time, the food culture over there was what it's now becoming like in Cambridge now. So emphasis on local, a real relationship that people had with the people that they were buying from through markets and stuff. And we were just really inspired by that. So it was the combination of that experience, unemployment, and an experience of buying cheese that led us to open a cheese shop in Cambridge, really. I work behind the scenes a lot and a little bit in the shop to really keep a feel for what's going on. But I have two very able right-hand people in the team, David Wilshin and Jade Thomas, who really are just like, if they weren't here, then I don't think this place would be here, really. So, yeah, it's a real team effort.
That's good. It does seem like a bit very family when you come into the shop.
Oh, does it? Oh, yeah. That's nice. Yeah, we like to think we do, you know, yeah, we do think of them as family, actually. I don't know whether they feel the same, but yes, it is a family. It's a small independent, you can't help. If you run your own business and you're passionate about what happens in your business and the things that you're selling, then that passion kind of like rolls out and it becomes a kind of family feel. I don't know any business that works on that basis that isn't family, doesn't have a family feel about it. So,
brilliant. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
It's nice to meet you properly.
You too. Thanks, Ruth.
Not only will you find the Cambridge Cheese Company in their shop, but also at Streatham Farmers Market, Wimble Market, and also at the Stourbridge Medieval Fair.
Jackie also does guided cheese tasting experiences, where she'll have various cheese boards and will pair them with wine, beer, cider, and even apple juices to show you how to explore the flavours. You can contact her at cambridgecheese@gmail.com for more details. She'll also have some lovely postcards with more details on her if you see her around.
Well, you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Coming up, we have Rioja wine, advice on growing your own fruit and vegetables, food trends for 2016, and food and drink news.
But first, coming up in May is the 4th annual Food and Drink Festival, Eat Cambridge. It's a really popular event and lasts for 2 weeks. Festival director Heidi White is in the throes of pulling it all together for this year and told Alan what sorts of things we can look forward to.
This year, we've got the return of some ever-popular Eat Cambridge events like the food debate, actually, which I know you'll personally be excited
yes, I
about.
I really enjoy it. Yeah.
That will be chaired by local food scientist Dr. Sue Bailey. I don't know if you know of her.
She has been on Flavour in the past, actually.
She's been on a few programmes like Food Unwrapped lately.
Yeah.
So that gives a bit of a hint about what the topic of the debate will be as well. But
well, that will be an well, if I'm taking the hint rightly, that will be very interesting because there are so many myths about food health, and health.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And we want to look at really where food and art meet science and how that fits into the Cambridge food scene.
Mm.
So yeah, that will be great with a panel that's yet to be announced. But, you know, you can imagine it will feature some good local speakers.
Great. And where is that event taking place?
That will be at the Cambridge Union Society.
Good, an excellent venue.
Yeah, we held it there 2 years ago, and it just added a bit of grandeur to the debate.
And what sort of other things have you got?
We've got some new events put on by local bloggers. So as well as the usual fringe events that are often hosted by companies and restaurants, we've got a group of local bloggers putting on some kind of foodie networking event. More events seem to be coming up along that theme that are kind of showcasing our growing community. And there's some more family-friendly events as well this year.
And there is still the main event at the...
Of course,
The big Corn Exchange.
The big main event, the huge food and drink fair. That will be at the Corn Exchange again, and that's on Saturday the 7th of May. So that event this time actually kicks off 2 weeks of fringe events.
Any idea what sort of numbers go to the main event? Because it does get quite crowded at times.
Yeah, we estimated between 4,000 and 5,000 each year the last 2 years. So it stayed roughly the same over the last 2 years. It didn't seem as crowded last year, so maybe people staggered it a bit and came at different times of day, but we also had more going on around the whole venue because we can use all the space, not just the main hall. So there were talks going on, which will be happening again.
Good.
They're in a separate room, so people get filtered off and go and do different
and
things.
Certainly so far there have been, I think, some really interesting talks from quite a diverse range of food connections, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. We like to include those who are directly involved with the festival, like people who are having a stall anyway or sponsoring, but also just smaller entities or individuals who have got something to say.
Yes.
This year, actually, we've just confirmed that Food Cycle will talk about their work that they do on food waste, and that's something people are really keen to know about.
What sort of events, is it possible to say what sort of events are the most popular? I suppose, logically, the main event is, but of the fringe events?
Well, at the risk of sounding biased, seeing as it's what I organise all year round, the street food event is always massively popular, really, really busy. And last year, it was just busier than ever. We actually had to sell tickets, and we sold out in advance over 1,000 tickets and could have sold them three times again. So there was just a huge
appetite
for it. That's
extraordinary, isn't it? So are you looking for a still bigger site for it?
No, we're actually hosting it at the same venue again. It will be hosted by Food Park again. We will ticket it, but we'll increase the number of traders so it won't feel so hectic and busy. There'll be more food choices, less queuing, hopefully. Although that is part of it, we have to remember.
Yeah, and the big favourites are inevitably going to have big queues, aren't they?
Yeah, of course, yeah. And they prepare for that, they know.
Yeah. When will the published programme be available for people to look at?
The end of March is the deadline we aim for the programme to be released. And then it's distributed the first week of April, let's say. So throughout April, people will be able to get their hands on a copy, look at it on the website and start to make bookings for fringe events and things.
One of the things that seems to have disappeared from the scene in Cambridge, Heidi, is supper clubs. When you go to somebody's house or flat and they cook for you and some fantastically unusual food sometimes and always good. They used to be part of Eat Cambridge, are they this
Definitely.
Year?
Definitely. I think you might even say that some of them started in the first Eat Cambridge in 2013. I mourn the loss of the proper supper club as well. Going to someone's house, secret location, you know, menu to be announced. But there aren't any coming up where people are inviting you into their home, unfortunately. I think it just has moved on slightly to pop-ups in venues or restaurants or on the street because the street food thing's got so big. There's a couple that I've been trying to encourage to do supper clubs at home in the coming year. There is one fringe event that may well be hosted at a food blogger's house to include a kind of food plating, fine dining photography workshop with a bit of food styling thrown in as well, but that's all to be confirmed. So as soon as we know more about that for the Eat Cambridge programme, I'll let you know.
Right, well, if anybody's interested in doing an old-style supper club and are listening to this, I hope they'll get in touch with you.
Yeah, right. They should do.
Will there be any pop-ups?
There will be some pop-ups in a different kind of theme from what we're used to. The Wandering Yak, the vegetarian street food van, for example, they're doing two pop-ups in quite interesting venues.
Right.
One, a street food feast, focusing on their vegetarian and vegan food, and another one's a kitchen takeover at a restaurant premises where they'll have matching, really interesting matching teas and drinks to go with their Middle Eastern food. So that's going to be quite a big one, I think,
that
people will
really
welcome with open arms,
yeah,
I hope.
Good.
And there's also a kind of one-off feast that the Pint Shop are running, which celebrates East Anglian food and produce, which I think will be really, really interesting.
Yeah, well, that's somewhere else you get real quality from, I think, the Pint Shop.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's brilliant. So will you be able to come along before the festival starts and tell us some more about it as it's developing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I hope so. As soon as I can say a bit more, I can tell you a bit more about the variety of stalls we've got, which will include some old favourites, but also definitely some new people.
Yeah.
The events programme, which is about 35 events strong, I'll be able to talk about that in more detail in the next month or so.
Well, we'll look forward to it. Thanks very much, Heidi.
Thank you.
Great, and that was Heidi White from Eat Cambridge, for which Burwash Manor is the headline sponsor and Cambridge 105 is media sponsor. And we'll have regular updates from Eat Cambridge over the coming months on Flavour and other Cambridge 105 programmes.
Now, this time last year on Flavour, we had a feature on food trends for 2015 with Nazima Pathan. Here's Nazima again, talking with Alan, this time on food trends for 2016.
Nazima, you're going to tell us about food trends for 2016, but before you do, where do they come from? Is it out of some advertising mogul's head, or
no?
Is it genuinely based on something?
There's a huge industry, obviously. People need to plan, supermarkets want to plan what will sell well next year and what will catch people's interest. So supermarkets will do their research, some of them publish it. Waitrose, for example, will do an end-of-year report on what's done well and what's growing. And there's a lot of industry in reports as well. And we do a sort of search of those. We read media from other press regarding what is up and coming. And what is up and coming will tend to be what chefs and bloggers are blogging about, new novel cuisines or trying to find parts, you know, regional cuisines that people haven't tried yet to bring things new. But people at the food obsessed end of the spectrum don't represent the mainstream. So I suppose when things build in popularity and gain a momentum, that's when it would be called a food trend.
Right. Okay. So what sort of food trends are developing at the moment then?
In terms of big food trends, the way people are eating and trying to be a little bit healthier is catching on a lot. There's obviously been a lot of food books, healthy food books out, some of which I agree with, like, and some of which I would agree with less. But certainly what's caught on is preparing low-carb meals, things such as spiralising vegetables to create noodles and use those in place of real pasta and real noodles.
On the basis that it's
lower carbohydrate, and obviously being a vegetable is good for you.
Yeah.
you know, in some situations that might be nice. Personally, I do like pasta. I wouldn't give it up. But it's an interesting thing to try for a different type of meal. And certainly now you can even buy pre-spiralised vegetables in most of the major supermarkets.
Well,
and
the spiralising has been done for you.
You don't even have to buy a spiraliser and put your effort self through that effort. Which is joy, because actually you get a bit of waste with a spiraliser, since I've got one. And you can buy ready-made meals. So I've seen in Marks and Spencer's, they have a bolognese with a beef bolognese with spiralized courgettes instead of spaghetti. And they have a cauliflower rice, which is essentially cauliflower grated into a rice-like texture, served with a chicken curry. So it's really mainstream now. And that's been growing in popularity for the last year or two, but certainly took off last year. So that's an example of a trend that started with the food obsessives. That's now really, you know, everywhere.
Yeah.
Even in suburban England. Other things. So fermenting. Fermenting means allowing vegetables or grains to ferment at room temperature, allowing the natural bacteria and yeast to grow and to produce something that is different in taste and nice in taste. It will have a slightly acidic taste, for example. So sourdough bread, for example, is an everyday example that we've all been enjoying for a long time. But now kimchi, the sort of Korean fermented cabbage, sauerkraut, kefir grains are all examples of you know, very popular fermented foods, and that's increasing in popularity. Talking of Korean food, that's been growing for quite a while. We certainly talked about that last year as being a food trend, and it appears, you know, to be, there's a lot of Korean restaurants opening in Cambridge, and well, there's one in Cambridge, there's lots of them in London, so that's something that's becoming more mainstream. Perhaps we'll see some prepped meals in Marks and Spencer's towards the end of this year.
Yeah.
Other regions of the world that are of interest and haven't yet been explored so much. We did read some reports of Filipino food, but there's very little exposure to that in this country, only even a few Filipino restaurants in London. So that might grow in popularity. That's one of the predictions we read. And another one is sub-Saharan Africa. So, so for example, South African cuisine, where there's a great food heritage and even some French influence in some parts of South Africa. But it's an area that's predicted to do well this
year.
Right,
and of course there's bunny chow now,
yes,
street
exactly.
food that comes to Cambridge.
Yes, so there's an example of something that is quite popular street food, where they hollow out a bread, a round of bread, and then put nice fillings in it. Perfect for winter as well. So in terms of ingredients, a couple of interesting ones. Seaweed is very popular now. You know, last year and the year before, everyone was, you know, obsessed with kale as the green veg of the moment. And this year it's seaweed, which actually is nice. I really think it has a nice flavour.
It's got a good texture as well, or it can have.
It's a nice texture. You can crumble it into dough and make a seaweed flakes in bread, or sprinkle it on noodles. I think it's a good one. It supplies, good nutrients, and it tastes good, and it gives a really nice umami flavour. Mm. Cauliflower, coming back to that, as well as turning it into rice, inverted commas, it's also roasting it whole. So people are into roasting these big, or even smoking and slowly cooking large vegetables in their whole form, and as a kind of trend towards a meaty presentation of vegetables. And cauliflower, roasted whole cauliflower, and in fact roasted whole celeriac, which we've done on our blog, and we ate at Midsummer House.
Well, I did as well.
The smoked celeriac was extraordinarily good. It was so inspired. So we ended up cooking it at home on our, we've got a barbecue, so we cooked it on our barbecue as well. Anyway, so it's a nice way to do it. It's cooking slow, cooking it at a low temperature, and it brings out a nice caramelised flavour, and really is a nice way to present a vegetarian main course. And then we other kinds of flavours. Well, a couple of things that we were going to found as trends. One is sort of adding a scatter of dust of burnt sort of edges of food as a sort of garnish, I suppose. You don't really want to eat much burnt food, but a sort of scraping of burnt leek and sprinkling that onto a leek and potato soup, for example, just gives it a nice
I suppose
edge.
A bit of added interest, yes. I suppose, really. Yeah.
And then another thing to do is infused flavours into ice cream. So cream can pick up any flavour you want to put into it, such as vanilla, obviously, but why not try other things? So, for example, you can put green tea, you could get cereal and just soak cereal in a load of creamy milk, full cream milk, and then make ice cream out of it. And we've done that. In fact, we did that in a supper club, and it tastes like cereal, and it's really nice. So that's obviously been popular in New York in the milk bar. That's one of their inventions. The other thing you can do is with rice or green tea. Again, jasmine rice is something we did once, and you slow cook some rice in some cream and then let that cool down and infuse for a night, and then the next day you take out the rice and then you prepare ice cream, or you could make panna cotta out of that cream, and it's very subtle, very delicious.
And we can read more about this on your website.
Yes, and I've got links to recipes and other sort of sources of inspiration for
Brilliant.
What we
And that's
predicted.
fromleykitchen.com.
Yes.
Right, thank you very much,
thank
Nazima.
You.
Thank
no
you.
Problem.
And that was Nazima Pathan from Frongley Kitchen.
Throughout last year, Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments provided us with really good advice on growing your own fruit and vegetables. And I caught up with him again on Wednesday to find out if there was much we could be doing now.
Right, Dave. January, you would imagine there's probably not a lot to do, but I'm guessing there probably is.
Well, yes, one option is doing nothing, but it's pretty cold, so that means that the sap is down in fruit trees and bushes, so that's a good time to prune them, or indeed to plant apple trees, pear trees, blackcurrant bushes, that sort of thing, if you want to. It's also a good time to feed fruit trees, and I'm using some wood ash from my wood-burning stove, so I just sprinkle that around the base of the tree, and that will be absorbed over the next couple of months and help along the flowers and the fruit that forms subsequently.
Right.
So it's been a really unusually warm winter so far, and I think that means that some of the winter crops have developed quite well. I've got some really good looking Brussels sprouts here, lots of nice large sprouts, or larger than I usually manage. The broccolis, the Romanesco, and even some of the sprouting broccoli has come on a lot earlier than I would have expected, so don't forget to go out and cut that and use it. It's just because of the season. It's been frosty the last few nights, but next week it's not going to be frosty, so that does mean that if we're really keen, we can start to prepare seed beds for things we're going to sow in a month or so. But I would say that before that, you want to decide what you're going to grow, and then decide where you're going to grow it, and then you can start thinking about actually preparing the ground. But also, don't forget to get your seed in. So make a seed order, or even better, get along to Seedy Sunday, which is this weekend. If you're listening to the Saturday broadcast, that's tomorrow, Sunday the 24th of January. And that's a wonderful seed swap event with lots of seeds to swap or to buy, and talks and stalls and lots of lovely tea and cake as well. So it's a lovely event. That's 1:30 at Trumpington Village Hall.
Right, well, I went last year, Dave, and I must say, I thought the quality of the tea and cakes was outstanding.
Yes, well, if you don't have to be a gardener to enjoy Seedy Sunday, that's for sure.
But also the Heritage Seed people were there. Will they be again?
Yes, they'll be there again, and they've got some lovely, interesting varieties that are not on the national seed list. And actually, they're responsible for having saved quite a few varieties that, because they were delisted, had no commercial sponsor because of the registration fees. And they're thus helping to preserve the diversity in the horticultural crops, which could be really important in the future.
Yes, and so you can go along and I know you can't buy them legally, but you can make a donation and get some of these.
I think that's how it works, yes.
Now, quite unusual seeds.
Yes, that's right. And they're fun as well, of course, because you can get black tomatoes and purple carrots and all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so don't forget your seed in before you start sowing, though, because otherwise you...
Yeah, and the first sort of things to be sown are what, parsnips?
Outside parsnips.
Yes, outside,
yes, that's right. So if conditions are right at the end of February, you can start putting things like parsnips and your first radish in. If you're really keen to, you know, get some seed in the soil, then why not bring a few pots on indoors, lettuce or spinach or early cabbage, that sort of thing, because then they'll be of a good size to harden off at the end of February and plant out if conditions are right. I mean, you know, that's if you're really keen. There's no harm in waiting a few weeks, because if we get a cold snap, and hopefully we will, then you're going to want to delay putting things out.
Does the sort of prolonged warm period at the end of last year mean there's going to be more pests around, or do you think the recent frost will have dealt them a blow?
I think inevitably there's going to be more pests.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, even we have had frost recently, but they've not been real deep killer frosts. I think we need a good couple of weeks, because there's so many nooks and crannies and crevices in a garden where things can overwinter. So yeah,
if it persists, this sort of warmer than usual weather, then perhaps at some stage we can talk about what we should do to deal with the pests, preferably without using artificial insecticides.
Absolutely. I mean, throw away all your old gardening books for a start, because I think the seasons are going to be very different. But what we have got nowadays is wonderfully accurate weather forecasts. So, you know, certainly the short and even the medium term are quite good now. So I think we can plan ahead a little bit and perhaps garden a little bit more tactically. If you're preparing seed beds ready for sowing, one thing you can do is to warm them up a little by putting cloches over them, or clear polythene, or garden fleece, anything just to get a couple of degrees higher temperature, because most seed does not germinate when soil temperature is below about 8 degrees Celsius. So if you can just make that difference in late February, early March, then you're giving yourself a good chance of getting off to a flying start. Again, that's only really for keenies, you know. If you want to leave everything to the end of March or whenever Easter falls and put your seed in, then you're still quite likely to have things pretty much catch up. I've got two top tips for this time of year. Firstly, if you've got any potatoes or apples in store, or any veg from last year's store, go and check it over. Make sure there's not a bad apple in your box, or check the mice or the rats haven't found it. And my other top tip is to save egg boxes, because if you're going to grow potatoes, you're going to want to chit those seed potatoes, and egg boxes are just the perfect size and shape for holding them with the rose end upwards, so the sprouts can grow nicely.
That's a really good idea, actually. I shall do that.
Great.
Okay, thanks very much, Dave.
No problem.
Well, good advice there. And Dave Fox will be back in 2 programmes' time and will doubtless be at CD Sunday tomorrow as well.
I love that bird song in there. It's
downright
idyllic.
Yes, it is.
People who opted for an alcohol-free January may find this next feature stretches their resolve to breaking point. Be warned.
Yes, it's time to pay a visit to the Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherry Hinton Road. Matt Bentman once again met with wine specialist Alice Archer, this time to learn about reds from northern Spain.
So today, Alice, we're talking about Rioja.
We are indeed, yes, Rioja, and excellent pronunciation there.
As in Rioja Dolce.
Quite, yes. And Rioja Moore, that famous Bond actor, of course.
But James, I need you.
So does England.
Anyway, it's not Rioja or Roger or Rioja or Roca, all of which I've heard in the last few days alone. Rioja, that harsh J. I'm going to focus on red Rioja here, the most commonly found style, but do be aware of the others. White Rioja can be young, fresh, unoaked and crisp, or rich, broad, oaky and brooding with great aging potential. Rioja, like Champagne, is an Appalachian name. In other words, it's a region in the north of Spain. Rioja wines come in many shapes and styles, red, white and rosé, and from a fair number of different grape varieties. But all those grapes must be grown in the region, and the subsequent wines must be categorised according to the strict ageing and maturation laws of the Rioja region.
More on ageing and maturation in a minute.
Wine making in Rioja, as we know it today, began in the second half of the 19th century when two noblemen from Bordeaux in France, the Marquess de Riscal and Marquess de Murrieta, set up wineries here. and the negociants of Bordeaux, whose crops had been wiped out by the devastating phylloxera bug, flooded in soon afterwards.
The phylloxera is a small aphid. It attacked in the 1860s. Now, it gets into the roots and it chews them up, and it swept across Europe, wiping out vineyards everywhere. First, your vines would display yellow leaves, and then they would wilt and die. Now, in desperation, people tried flooding the vineyards so that whatever was attacking them would drown, because they still didn't really know what was causing it. However, when they did find out, the solution was to graft the tops of the European vines onto the more resistant rootstock from another continent. So, all modern vines in Europe are essentially a grafting. It's the leaves and the blossoms that provide the flavour of the wines, and these were fortunately preserved before all the vineyards were overtaken. The overseas roots simply help provide a stronger plumbing. So all of our European vineyards were replanted just with better plumbing. The original flavours were preserved. Job done. Anyway, back to the Rioja. I just like bugs.
The Rioja region in Spain is split into three sub-regions: Rioja Alta, Rioja Alavesa, and Rioja Baja.
A region 100 kilometres long. Each area has its own climate and terroir, bringing diversity to the wines. Now, terroir is a French term. It refers to remarkable soil range, and that's something that the Rioja region has in spades. Well, three spades at least.
You might hear that Rioja Alta and Rioja Alavesa are better than Rioja Baja, but that's not always the case. You can find great Rioja wines from all over. Just look at the producer and the vintage.
It's cooler in the Alta region, and it's higher up with a more clay-like soil, and this gives the grapes a higher tannin and acidity. In the middle is Rioja Alavesa, with more rolling hills. And then the Rioja Baja region on the right is a bit warmer as it drops down onto the flat and heads towards the river. The soil here is a bit more lime and chalky, and the vineyards in this region produce a more rounded, lush wine. They're typically ready to drink right away.
Rioja Baja wines are often designed to be drunk young, and Rioja Alta are designed for long ageing. There are five permitted red grape varieties in Rioja: Tempranillo, Garnacha, Mazuelo, Graciano, and another one called Maturana Tinto. Tempranillo, however, accounts for 75% of the region's vineyards. It's a medium to full-bodied red grape variety, packed with red fruit characteristics and a savoury backbone that ages gracefully to develop more earthy and meaty notes. But what about the label? It often won't mention these grape varieties on the label. Instead, you'll find words Joven, Crianza, Reserva, and Gran Reserva. Joven means low or no oak. Young, fruity, zippy, low in tanning, often lacking richness and complexity, but good, easygoing, everyday wines. For Crianza, the wines must have had 1 year in oak and 1 year in bottle. This is the benchmark, and certainly the most accessible style of richer Rioja price-wise, as it's often under a tenner per bottle. The aim is often to be a high-quality, everyday drinking wine, with good body, some richness to back up the fruits found in the Joven style. Reserva. This has to have 1 year in oak, but it then has to have had 2 years in bottle. This is selected wines from the best vintages with excellent potential. This is where Rioja starts to taste serious. At the Reserva level, winemakers often age their wines for a lot longer than the minimum and select better grapes. Many Rioja enthusiasts swear by Reserva level because they're the medium between super fruity Crianza and really oaky bottle-aged Gran Reservas. Gran Reservas are, nevertheless, great wines. They have to have had 2 years in oak and 3 years in bottle. These wines are mostly only made in exceptional vintages. The Gran Reserva level of Rioja experiences the most oak aging, giving it more tannic structure and more age-worthy potential as well. Rioja is really particularly versatile food wine, and that's not just with Spanish food. Bodegas Baronia, as just mentioned, is a prime example. It's a winery actually founded on food. In the Basque region of northern Spain, there's an old tradition of gastronomic societies where men with a passion for food and wine meet to cook, eat and drink. It was a group of friends that had one of these societies that wanted to produce their own fine wines to go with their food, and they realised they were right next door to a great winemaking region. So they set up Bodegas Baronia in order to make wine to have with their supper clubs, essentially, which is not a bad reason to do it. And they're now one of the finest producers there is. The main thing to bear in mind when trying to match Rioja with food is the style of the wine. For the reds, consider whether it's a young Rioja, a Joven, which can handle quite robust, even spicy dishes, or an older Gran Reserva, one which would benefit from more simply prepared food. Riojas that are made in the more modern style, as mentioned above, with some of that French and Hungarian oak, can also handle more spice than more traditional ones. Modern Indian food with Rioja is a surprising hit. In other ways, any kind of lamb dish is divine with all styles of Rioja. Joven and Crianza wines work particularly well with a little bit of spice and red peppers, touch of sweetness too, dishes like a Moroccan tagine. Be careful though, as spicy food with a complex, powerful Gran Reserva could easily be overwhelming and would be a little bit of a waste of some very good wine.
And that was Alice Archer of the Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherry Hinton Road. Alice gives many wine talks and tasting evenings at the branch, and you can get details from their website.
And they've just announced a new gin club, which will take place on their site on the first Tuesday of every month. The club will feature five gins, some nibbles, and discounts for regulars. The first one begins in February, and to check, pop by their shop or look online and call Cambridge 214 548 to book. And on to the food and drink news now, starting with the university news. Gigi Perry is back with us. Welcome back, Gigi. How's life?
Busy, but great, thank you.
Okay, what news from the university?
Well, this Sunday you have the opportunity to try out to become a member of the Cambridge University Blind Wine Tasting Team for 2016. The tasting will be sat under exam conditions without talking and conferring, and exam sheets will be marked to determine ranking. You'll receive six whites and six reds with 40 minutes for each, and you'll subsequently be scored on your guesses for the dominant grape, country, region and sub-region of origin, vintage and your tasting notes. They will select 10 Cambridge students, from among whom seven will represent Cambridge against Oxford in the Paul Roger Varsity match on February the 17th. Smaller teams will also be sent to international competitions in Lausanne, Champagne, Bordeaux and London. So don't be shy to attend, there are quite a few places on offer and it's really worth trying out even for novices. Tickets can be bought online for £14 and it takes place at Churchill College on Sunday the 24th of January at 7pm.
That sounds great, Gigi. Are you going to do it?
Do you know, I know so little about wine. Right, I think I'm worse than a novice.
And you haven't got time to find out, you know.
And if you want to escape the cold English winter, then Cambridge University Wine Society are offering a solution of a kind. Join them on Monday the 25th of January for their tour of Italy with Ciro Bellini from La Volpe e l'Uva, a traditional Italian wine bar based in Florence. For nearly 20 years, they have created a unique selection of the finest Italian wines from lesser-known wineries. These small boutique wineries have been carefully selected because of their wine's quality and harmonic taste. To join them and escape the winter blues, check out Cambridge University Wine Society's website. And while you're online, keep your eyes peeled for the Society's Burgundy Tour as well, which will take place on Thursday the 4th of February. Further details will be announced online, but it takes place with Bruno Pepin and promises to be a delicious evening with lots to learn. But you really are spoilt for choice, because also taking place on Thursday the 4th of February is Cambridge University Whisky Appreciation Society's Deluxe Whisky Tasting, priced at £30. Tickets can be bought on their website. The Society always put on truly magnificent events, so make sure you book up early so not to miss out.
Well, that does sound fantastic. Why aren't I a student anymore? Thanks, Gigi. And on to the city news now. Ruth?
Starting with tonight, where Provenance Kitchen will be at the Country Kitchen in Haslingfield with treats like wood-fired spiced butternut squash, hay-smoked sea trout and 36-hour beef brisket and so on. Mm,
but if you're intent on a more beery evening, go to the Cambridge Winter Ale Festival at the University Social Club in Mill Lane, open till 10:30 tonight and food orders until 9:30. It's £3 for non-members.
Tomorrow is the last day for nominations for the BBC Food Awards. There are so many Cambridge producers we could nominate. Go to the BBC website to nominate.
And a reminder about an event tomorrow. Seedy Sunday brings you seed merchants, including the Heritage Seed Library, a seed swap and various other stalls, talks on wildlife gardening and on seeds and the smallholder too. There will be teas, coffees and cakes as well. It's at Trumpington Village Hall tomorrow from 1:30 till 4 and it costs £2.
If battered Mars bars are more your thing, go to the Cambridge Brew House on Monday for Burns Night. There's haggis as well and some great beers brewed on the premises. That's in King Street.
Food Park will be back next Wednesday at the West Cambridge site and Friday in Station Road from 12 till 2.
And looking further ahead, Jalan Jalan will be popping up at Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street on the 20th of February, 12 till 3 and 6 till 9. And at Novi in Regent Street on the 10th and 24th of February.
And also at Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street on the 13th of February, Holy Schnitzels will be there from 6 till 9. And looking further ahead, on the 11th of March, Que Rico Tapas is at the Cambridge Spanish Centre in Hills Road. I didn't know there was one. From 6 till 7:30 with a taste of Spanish jamon. Three tastings and a glass of wine, £15. Book on Cambridge 561 854.
And looking even further ahead, we are telling you now because they will sell out fast. On the 15th of March at the Park Restaurant in Cambridge Regional College, there's an apprentice dinner with mini courses for £22.50. And the following day, on the 23rd of March, a fine dining dinner for £24.50. Book via the Cambridge Regional College website, but do it soon.
And we've just got time to mention that Cam Events Valentine pop-up, which takes place at Sticky Beaks, is sold out, but a table for two is being given away. Just register for number volunteers for Cambridge at www.volunteerforcambridge.co.uk on the internet, and you can be drawn out to see whether you get a free table for two. And that's all we have time for today. Many thanks to Julian Clover. Thanks to Julian Clover for operating the sound desk. And why not listen all over again? We're repeated at 7 a.m. tomorrow on Cambridge 105 and podcast from early next week. Coming up next is Bookmark, in which Lee Chambers speaks with ex-Cabinet Minister Charles Clarke. Then it's 105 Sport. That's followed at 5 p.m. by Radio Dante, our English-Italian show. And at 6 o'clock, it's Jason Allen with music focusing mainly on the 80s and 90s. Remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Twitter at flavour105. Until our next programme on the 6th of February, from all of us, goodbye.
Goodbye.